Chapter 9. At 60 mile they restocked provisions, added a few pounds of letters to their load, and held steadily on. From 40 mile they had an unbroken trail, and they could look forward only to unbroken trail clear to Daya. Daylight stood it magnificently, but the killing pace was beginning to tell on Kama. His pride kept his mouth shut, but the result of the chilling of his lungs and the cold snap could not be concealed. Microscopically small had been the edges of the lung tissue touched by the frost, but they now began to slough off, giving rise to a dry, hacking cough. Any unusually severe exertion precipitated spells of coughing, during which he was almost like a man in a fit. The blood congested in his eyes till they bulged, while the tears ran down his cheeks. A whiff of the smoke from frying bacon would start him off for a half hour's paroxysm, and he kept carefully to windward when daylight was cooking. They plodded days upon days, and without end over the soft, unpacked snow. It was hard, monotonous work, with none of the joy and blood stir that went with flying over hard surface. Now one man to the fore in the snowshoes, and now the other. It was a case of stubborn, unmitigated plod. A yard of powdery snow had to be pressed down, and the wide-webbed shoe, under a man's weight, sank a full dozen inches into the soft surface. Snowshoe work, under such conditions, called for the use of muscles other than those used in ordinary walking. From step to step the rising foot could not come up and forward on a slant. It had to be raised perpendicularly. When the snowshoe was pressed into the snow, its nose was confronted by a vertical wall of snow 12 inches high. If the foot, in rising, slanted forward the slightest bit, the nose of the shoe penetrated the obstructing wall and tipped downward till the heel of the shoe struck the man's leg behind. Thus up, straight up, 12 inches, each foot must be raised every time and all the time, ere the forward swing from the knee could begin. On this partially packed surface followed the dogs, the man at the gee-pole, and the sled. At the best, toiling as only picked men could toil, they made no more than 3 miles an hour. This meant longer hours of travel, and daylight, for good measure, and for a margin against accidents, hit the trail for 12 hours a day. Since 3 hours were consumed by making camp at night and cooking beans, by getting breakfast in the morning and breaking camp, and by thawing beans at the midday halt, 9 hours were left for sleep and recuperation, and neither men nor dogs wasted many minutes of those 9 hours. At Selkirk, the trading post near Pelly River, daylight suggested that Kama lay over, rejoining him on the back trip from Daya. A straight Indian from Lake Labarge was willing to take his place, but Kama was obdurate. He grunted with a slight intonation of resentment, and that was all. The dogs, however, daylight changed, leaving his own exhausted team to rest up against his return, while he went on with 6 fresh dogs. They traveled till 10 o'clock the night they reached Selkirk, and at 6 next morning they plunged ahead into the next stretch of wilderness of nearly 500 miles that lay between Selkirk and Daya. A second cold snap came on, but cold or warm it was all the same, an unbroken trail. When the thermometer went down to 50 below, it was even harder to travel, for at that low temperature the hard frost crystals were more like sand grains in the resistance they offered to the sled runners. The dogs had to pull harder than over the same snow at 20 or 30 below zero. Daylight increased the day's travel to 13 hours. He jealously guarded the margin he had gained, for he knew there were difficult stretches to come. It was not yet quite midwinter, and the turbulent 50-mile river vindicated his judgment. In many places it ran wide open, with precarious rim ice fringing it on either side. In numerous places, where the water dashed against the steep-sided bluffs, rim ice was unable to form. They turned and twisted, now crossing the river, now coming back again, sometimes making half a dozen attempts, before they found a way over a particularly bad stretch. It was slow work. The ice bridges had to be tested, and either daylight or comma went in advance, snowshoes on their feet, and long poles carried crosswise in their hands. Thus, if they broke through, they could cling to the pole that bridged the hole made by their bodies. Several such accidents were the share of each. At 50 below zero, a man wet to the waist cannot travel without freezing, so each ducking meant delay. As soon as rescued, the wet man ran up and down to keep up his circulation, while his dry companion built a fire. Thus protected, a change of garments could be made, and the wet ones dried against the next misadventure. To make matters worse, this dangerous river travel could not be done in the dark, and their working day was reduced to the 6 hours of twilight. Every moment was precious, and they strove never to lose one. Thus, before the first hint of the coming of gray day, camp was broken, sled loaded, dogs harnessed, and the two men crouched waiting over the fire. Nor did they make the midday halt to eat. As it was, they were running far behind their schedule, each day eating into the margin they had run up. There were days when they made 15 miles, and days when they made a dozen. And there was one bad stretch, where in 2 days they covered 9 miles, being compelled to turn their backs 3 times on the river, and to portage sled and outfit over the mountains. At last they cleared the dread 50-mile river, and came out on Lake LaBarge. Here was no open water nor jammed ice. For 30 miles or more the snow lay level as a table, with alec lay 3 feet deep, and was soft as flour. 3 miles an hour was the best they could make, but daylight celebrated the passing of the 50-mile by traveling late. At 11 in the morning they emerged at the foot of the lake. At 3 in the afternoon, as the Arctic night closed down, he caught his first sight of the head of the lake, and with the first stars took his bearings. At 8 in the evening they left the lake behind, and entered the mouth of the Lewis River. Here a halt of half an hour was made, while chunks of frozen boiled beans were thawed, and the dogs were given an extra ration of fish. Then they pulled on up the river till 1 in the morning, when they made their regular camp. They had hit the trail 16 hours on end that day. The dogs had come in too tired to fight among themselves or even snarl, and Kama had perceptibly limped the last several miles. Yet daylight was on trail next morning at 6 o'clock. By 11 he was at the foot of White Horse, and that night saw him camped beyond the Box Cannon, the last bad river stretched behind him, the string of lakes before him. There was no let up in his pace. 12 hours a day, 6 in the twilight, and 6 in the dark, they toiled on the trail. 3 hours were consumed in cooking, repairing harnesses, and making and breaking camp, and the remaining 9 hours dogs and men slept as if dead. The iron strength of Kama broke. Day by day the terrific toil sapped him. Day by day he consumed more of his reserves of strength. He became slower of movement, the resiliency went out of his muscles, and his limp became permanent. Yet he labored stoically on, never shirking, never grunting a hint of complaint. Daylight was thin-faced and tired. He looked tired. Yet somehow, with that marvelous mechanism of a body that was his, he drove on, ever on, remorselessly on. Never was he more a god in Kama's mind than in the last days of the southbound traverse, as the failing Indian watched him, ever to the fore, pressing onward with urgency of endurance such as Kama had never seen, nor dreamed could thrive in human form. The time came when Kama was unable to go in the lead and break trail, and it was a proof that he was far gone when he permitted daylight to toil all day at the heavy snowshoe work. Lake by lake they crossed the string of lakes from Marsh to Linderman, and began the ascent of Chilkoot. By all rights, daylight should have camped below the last pitch of the pass at the dim end of day. But he kept on and over and down to Sheep Camp, while behind him raged a snowstorm that would have delayed him 24 hours. This last excessive strain broke Kama completely. In the morning he could not travel. At 5, when called, he sat up after a struggle, groaned, and sank back again. Daylight did the camp work of both, harnessed the dogs, and, When ready for the start, rolled the helpless Indian in all three sleeping robes, and lashed him on top of the sled. The going was good. They were on the last lap, and he raced the dogs down through Diacanon, and along the hard-packed trail that led to Diapost. And running still, comma groaning on top the load, and Daylight leaping at the G-pole, to avoid going under the runners of the flying sled, they arrived at Dia by the sea. True to his promise, Daylight did not stop. An hour's time saw the sled loaded with the ingoing mail and grub, fresh dogs harnessed, and a fresh Indian engaged. Kama never spoke from the time of his arrival till the moment Daylight, ready to depart, stood beside him to say goodbye. They shook hands. "You kill 'em, that damn Indian," Kama said. "Aye, Daylight? You kill 'em. He'll sure last as far as Pelly," Daylight grinned. Kama shook his head doubtfully, and rolled over on his side, turning his back in token of farewell. Daylight won across Chilkoot that same day, dropping down 500 feet in the darkness and the flurrying snow to Crater Lake, where he camped. It was a cold camp, far above the timber line, and he had not burdened his sled with firewood. That night 3 feet of snow covered them, and in the black morning, when they dug themselves out, the Indian tried to desert. He had had enough of traveling with what he considered a madman. But Daylight persuaded him in grim ways to stay by the outfit, and they pulled on across Deep Lake and Long Lake, and dropped down to the level going of Lake Linderman. It was the same killing pace going in as coming out, and the Indian did not stand it as well as Kama. He, too, never complained. Nor did he try again to desert. He toiled on, and did his best, while he renewed his resolve to steer clear of Daylight in the future. The days slipped into days, nights, and twilights alternating. Cold snaps gave way to snowfalls, and cold snaps came on again, and all the while, through the long hours, the miles piled up behind them. But on the 50-mile accident befell them. Crossing an ice bridge, the dogs broke through, and were swept under the downstream ice. The traces that connected the team with the wheel dog parted, and the team was never seen again. Only the one wheel dog remained, and Daylight harnessed the Indian and himself to the sled. But a man cannot take the place of a dog at such work, and the two men were attempting to do the work of five dogs. At the end of the first hour, Daylight lightened up. Dog food, extra gear, and the spare axe were thrown away. Under the extraordinary exertion, the dog snapped a tendon the following day, and was hopelessly disabled. Daylight shot it, and abandoned the sled. On his back he took 160 pounds of mail and grub, and on the Indians put 125 pounds. The stripping of gear was remorseless. The Indian was appalled when he saw every pound of worthless mail matter retained, while beans, cups, pails, plates, and extra clothing were thrown by the board. One robe each was kept, one axe, one tin pail, and a scant supply of bacon and flour. Bacon could be eaten raw on a pinch, and flour, stirred in hot water, could keep men going. Even the rifle and the score of rounds of ammunition were left behind. And in this fashion they covered the 200 miles to Selkirk. Daylight traveled late and early, the hours formerly used by camp making and dog tending being now devoted to the trail. At night they crouched over a small fire, wrapped in their robes, drinking flour broth and thawing bacon on the ends of sticks. And in the morning darkness, without a word, they arose, slipped on their packs, adjusted head straps, and hit the trail. The last miles into Selkirk, Daylight drove the Indian before him, a hollow-cheeked, gaunt-eyed wraith of a man who else would have lain down and slept, or abandoned his burden of mail. At Selkirk, the old team of dogs, fresh and in condition, were harnessed, and the same day saw Daylight plodding on, alternating places at the G-pole, as a matter of course, with the LaBarge Indian who had volunteered on the way out. Daylight was 2 days behind his schedule, and falling snow and unpacked trail kept him 2 days behind all the way to 40 Mile. and here the weather favored. It was time for a big cold snap, and he gambled on it, cutting down the weight of grub for dogs and men. The men of 40 Mile shook their heads ominously, and demanded to know what he would do if the snow still fell. That cold snap's sure got to come, he laughed, and mushed out on the trail. A number of sleds had passed back and forth already that winter between 40 Mile and Circle City, and the trail was well packed. And the cold snap came and remained, and Circle City was only 200 miles away. The LaBarge Indian was a young man, unlearned yet in his own limitations, and filled with pride. He took daylight's pace with joy, and even dreamed, at first, that he would play the white man out. The first 100 miles he looked for signs of weakening, and marveled that he saw them not. Throughout the second 100 miles he observed signs in himself, and gritted his teeth and kept up. And ever daylight flew on, running at the G-pole or resting his spell on top the flying sled. The last day, clearer and colder than ever, gave perfect going, and they covered 70 miles. It was 10 at night when they pulled up the earth bank and flew along the main street of Circle City, and the young Indian, though it was his spell to ride, leaped off and ran behind the sled. It was honorable braggadocio, and despite the fact that he had found his limitations and was pressing desperately against them, he ran gamely on. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.